I'm gonna start off with racism on a personal basis. For reasons of my own, I chose to not to go over to Vietnam. Behind this, I was railroaded and handcuffed and taken under guard to Vietnam. They forwarded orders to my company commander of my background when I was in basic and AIT, relevant to my behavior. From the jump, he discriminated against me. I was commonly preferred to as a field nigger. I was on an operation. We were under attack by a regiment of VC. The outcome was like 7 or 8 guys out of about 35 left. The first thing my first sergeant did when he called in was to find out if I was dead or not. The majority of my company consists of white guys, but the majority of brothers are in the field. The ratio was like 60 to 40. And most brothers, Puerto Ricans and Mexicans, have to walk point to more or less prove their manhood or on an individual basis that they are just as much man as the next guy. Consequently, to this here, it was all forms of racism. I was in
WBAI New York
for 3 months. I saw a brother fed rat poison because he chose not to do some of the things that the racist MPs asked him to do. A lot of brothers were beaten, handcuffed, and gagged, and thrown in solitary confinement without food. My first meal in solitary confinement was mashed potatoes and coffee grounds. That was it. You'd be surprised at the things that happened over there. I came home, and I tried to apply for some money from VA. They told me, well, look, you wait 2 weeks or a month, come back, you know, later on when we get the chance. I came back in 2 weeks, I had to fill out more forms, more paperwork. You know, I kept getting a runaround, et cetera. Since I've been home, I can relate this to a lot of guys, white and black. It's hard to find employment for veterans. Dig it. Now, like, I don't understand what the big thing is. All the guys are coming home from Vietnam and can't find work. Like, it should be some type of system where a brother or anybody coming home from Vietnam is guaranteed employment. I went back to my old job, and the guy told me, he says, good, you know, when do you want to start? Today or tomorrow? So I says, well, I'll start tomorrow. And he looks on my DD-214, which is my Army discharge files, and then he looked on there and he saw that I was in Vietnam. He said, what did you do? I said, inventory. He says, wait a minute. He came back in 2 minutes later and told me he didn't need me. I took a test with 150 guys and only 20 passed. And just because I had a general discharge, I wasn't accepted at that particular corporation. That's all I got to say.
Thank you. My name's Murphy Lloyd, and right here before me, I have 2 discharges. Yeah, well, I went in twice. I went in 61 to 63. And something funny happened. Around 66, I got patriotic because the president said he needed men to fight in Vietnam. And at the time, I really believed that I had just as much to fight for as anybody else in Vietnam, regardless of what color you were. I just felt that this was my country, too. But upon arriving to Vietnam, I found a different story altogether. From first thing, I arrived to Vietnam on a Saturday. And Sunday morning, I had been awarded a CIB. That's a combat infantry badge to start with. And going on, after receiving this, I was, you know, things just started to, that I didn't want to believe were actually happening. I had been hearing about how racist the Army was, but I didn't want to believe this because I judge a man not by his color, but by him being a man, regardless of what he is. But I started finding that out in the field, I went over there as a communication specialist. And while receiving my gear, the man told me, I'm sorry, we don't need a communication specialist, we need a grunt. Well, they got to issue me claymore mines and all this, but which I didn't know anything about. And when I got out in the field, I noticed that 90% of the outfit out there were from minority groups. They weren't just black, they were Chicanos, Indians, and anything else you want to name anyone. We were there. And quite naturally, we couldn't complain about rank because we were all getting the rank because there wasn't anyone else out there to get the rank but us because we were in the leadership position. See? Yeah, I mean, this is true. You know, I wouldn't lie to you. Why? But you know, it's funny, really, when you look back at it, though. Just how many people did just like, I just jumped up and said, well, boom, my country needs me. And I went over there to fight and come back home to this thing here that they call freedom. And last night, while on the way home, after leaving a meeting over on, what's that street, Emerson? Yeah, the police stopped me. So I go in my pocket to give a policeman my license, and he happens to see this. And he's, oh yeah, well, I stand up and let you see. And he made a statement about Miss Fonda. I wouldn't like to use the words here, but wow, it was pretty deep. So like I told him, I was doing what I felt that I had to do. So there I go down to jail. So I spent the night in jail last night. If you see me nod every now and then, it's from that.
Sisters and brothers, we just received word from Detroit that United States Senator George McGovern, Democrat, South Dakota, and Representative John Conyers, Democrat, Michigan, called today for immediate investigation by the United States Senate. Investigation by the United States Senate and House of Representatives of allegations arising from testimony given by a group of honorably discharged United States veterans of war in Vietnam at the three-day winter soldier investigation being conducted in Detroit. Chief amongst these charges are reports that the United States committed ground troops action inside Laos as long ago as February 1969. Contrary to affirmations by government officials that no such incursions had occurred, Senator McGovern charged that the Winter Soldier investigation testimony provides evidence of administration's growing credibility gap in Indochina military affairs. Last week, Senator McGovern said, we were told by Defense Secretary Melvin Laird that our combat groups have not operated outside Vietnam. A few days ago, we learned that some of our service men were on the ground in Cambodia. Now there are reports of invasions into Laos as long ago as early 1969. These are serious charges which require immediate and intensive review. The American people must know all the facts about our military policy in Indochina. Congressman Conyers recalls similar reports he received during his 1969 tour of Vietnam. The charges that our command office sanctioned interrogation by torture and other brutal acts, the occurrence of atrocities without investigation or punishment, and that racism still pervades our armed forces require complete disclosure. I shall ask for the full transcript of the Winter Soldier investigation hearings, and I will propose... that these veterans be brought to Washington to deliver their testimony before the appropriate congressional authority. During During the first day of public hearings, 35 veterans of Vietnam service described a wide variety of atrocities and war crimes in which they participated or which they witnessed during their tours of duty, often in the presence and with the approval of their officers. The veterans' testimony included charges of the killing of unarmed women, children, and elderly peasants, the use of torture to elicit information from captured prisoners, the shooting of enemy soldiers attempting to surrender, and the wanton burning of Vietnam villages. Veterans who served with the 1st Marine Division in Quang Nam Province of South Vietnam told of an American ambush executed on Christmas Eve, 1969, during what was to have been a ceasefire for U.S. ground troops. The witness said 25 Vietnamese were killed, but only one weapon was actually found. An officer then gathered previously captured weapons from other units in the area to justify the labeling of the new kills as enemy soldiers. The Detroit Free Press confirmed this incident from another Marine who had been present in Vietnam at that time but was unaware of the Winter Soldier investigation. His recollection was that there had been 31 persons killed in the ambush.
Let's go to Washington and tell the world about it. How about it?
Sonny, could you amplify a little on what you were talking about?
The civilians, the relocation? Okay. We were in an operation in Hobo Woods. I believe it was Cedar Falls or Junction City in January of 67. We came across a village of women, young kids and old men, no young men. We surrounded the village, then we forced all the civilians out into an open field. We called in a Chinook, large helicopter. At gunpoint, we held these people until the Chinook arrived. Then we forced all of them onto the chopper to be taken to Saigon, I believe. And then we destroyed all of their hooches. We dumped all of the rice down in their wells, killed all of the livestock, and left the place a real scorched earth. Prior to that, in December, we were running convoys day and night for Operation Attleboro up at Tay Ninh. One night, we ran approximately 50 trucks back down to Coochie. We got there. You could tell that these trucks were heavily laden. They were really weighted down. Now we got there, and my squad leader went over and talked to a lieutenant. He came back and said that the lieutenant had told him that these trucks were weighted down with American bodies. I didn't see inside the trucks, so it is hearsay. But I do know that Stars and Stripes reported about a week later that we had taken light casualties, and 50 trucks loaded with American dead is more than light casualties.
We'd like to move along to a panel on information specialists and on press censorship. Larry Rotman.
My name is Larry Rotman.
I served as Assistant Information Officer for the 25th Infantry Division, based at Coochee, Vietnam, from June 5th, 1967 to March 19, 1968. My duties were to be officer in charge of the division newspaper, Tropic Lightning News, the Lightning 25 monthly news magazine, and the Lightning 25 AFVN radio program. I was also in charge of division press releases, including photos, officer in charge of visiting newsmen, including television network crews, and a frequent briefer of the division staff on all civilian news media and information matters. I'd like to introduce the rest of the members of the information panel. Mike McCusker, who was information specialist with the Marines. Larry Craig, who was information specialist at brigade level in the 25th Division. Vernon Scheibler, who was an information specialist on the division headquarters level. Brigade level. Alex Prim, who was an information specialist at the 1st Logistical Command headquarters. Those men will identify themselves and give you a little background of... My name is Larry Rotman, R-O-T-T-M-A-N-N. I'm not listed on that that handout. Mike, you want to start out?
My name is Mike McCusker. I was a sergeant in the Marine Corps, and I served in Vietnam in 1966 and 67. With the 1st Marine Division as what they called an infantry combat correspondent. This meant I went out with every unit of the infantry that was stationed in generally in Chulai, but I ended up all over the I Corps with almost every Marine infantry unit and also reconnaissance unit because I was also reconnaissance qualified. These things that the men from the 125th have told you were covered up. None of these instances were generally reported. Most of the stories that we wrote generally appeared in such publications as Stars and Stripes, a paper we had in I Corps area called Sea Tiger, various other military news services, and the civilian press. They appeared in ways that we did not even write them. Information in them was either deleted or added, and quite often, what we had written, what we had seen, what we had covered, just didn't come out in the stories. It was something entirely different. The general policy of being an informational services man, that's what the Marine Corps calls its reporters, its informational services office. The only thing we had to do with information, I believe, was to cover it up, disguise it, or deny it. Now, some of the things that we could not write about, and if we did write about them, they were always redlined from our stories, were the amount of American dead. Now, they'd always go into light casualties. We in our stories could not even write light casualties. But the thing was light casualties, medium casualties, or heavy casualties. However, heavy casualties were never reported upon because when they got to Da Nang, and if they did mention casualties in the Da Nang press center, then they would just, if a platoon went out and got wiped out, then they would measure the platoon by battalion strength, and that would, of course, be light casualties, and play those little games. Every Vietnamese dead was naturally a Viet Cong dead, even six-month-old babies, 99-year-old men or women. If they're dead, they are Viet Cong, which is a misnomer at any rate. We could never really write about the Vietnamese lifestyle or how the Vietnamese view their life and their universe because it's so contrary to how we view Vietnam and the purpose of Vietnam. And the dichotomy would be very apparent in any story. We could not write of taking souvenirs. Souvenirs that we witnessed being taken, such as ears and teeth. You can't help but notice it because it happens all the time. And if you did write of it, it would be redlined, and of course you would be on the carpet if your informational services office could find you out in the field. He could not write of villages being burned, of crops destroyed. He could not write of defoliation, of the use of tear gas. Use of tear gas on at least three occasions. I witnessed tear gas pumped into caves and people running out and shot down as they ran out of those caves. When the story of tear gas being used in 7th Marines in 1965 was exploded, Colonel Oscar Petras, who was the regimental commander at the time, said it was only for humane purposes. And I witnessed a few of those humane purposes, and I did write it in a story, infuriated, and it was redlined. The use of napalm. You can't even use the term napalm anymore. It's called incendiary gel, like jello. You could not write of women guerrillas, or women prisoners, especially the deaths of women, children, old men, and women. You could not write of H&I fire, which is harassment and interdiction. I had to cover it for the division. This colonel went in with a bunch of newsmen to this one particular village. The medical team had preceded him, as had a chow team, and they'd set up hot chow, and they passed out the Band-Aids and the Kool-Aid. And they only gave medical supplies enough for 2 days in any particular village, because if they gave these medical supplies to a village lasting longer than 2 days, the NLF would get to those supplies and use them. So therefore, though the medical teams might not visit a particular village for a period of a month, maybe, they would only leave supplies for 2 days. The villages definitely needed medical help, essentially because, as I testified yesterday, we systematically destroyed most of any village dispensary or hospital or anything that looked like it. We could not write, at the time I was there, of what was called Puff the Magic Dragon, which DC-3s with miniguns. I forgot how many rounds they can throw out a minute, around 4,000, I believe it is. 6,000? They can cover an entire football field in about a minute. And it just destroys, chops down every damn thing in sight. We could not write of those. Could not write especially of the torture of prisoners. My witnessing of the torture of prisoners was generally on the field level. Whenever any particular outfit, whether it be squad size, company size, or battalion size, swept into a ville on a search and destroy mission and captured prisoners, which meant any Vietnamese hanging around the ville, or any Vietnamese flushed out of the bush if he wasn't shot first. And they had field torture techniques, determining who was going to go in to the more refined tortures, which involved somewhat the same type. In the field was the use of dogs after tying a suspect who was any particular villager to a tree and letting the dog start yapping at his face, snapping at him. The use of field phones wired to genitals, to ears, to nose. Threatenings with a knife, dunking in wells, dunking in rivers and streams. And we could write of none of these, and if you did write of these, they would be redlined. Could not write of recon fire missions. Now, as I said before, I was reconnaissance qualified, jump qualified, et cetera, et cetera. So I was the only man recon trusted to go out with them, only reporter photographer the recon trusted, because I knew their business. And recon was a little bit different than what I'd been trained to do. Generally in Vietnam, you would take a few helicopters, land in an area, move out on top of a hill and call in arty strikes or airstrikes in a particular given area. A couple times, one particular time, I watched a herd of elephants get hit by arty. Several villages. Could never write of this, could never write of how it was done and what the rationale for it was. Now, this redlining of stories, that was a very complex thing. I was out in the field. I was way the hell out in the field. I tried getting so far out that nobody from division could find me. All they would ever see of me was stories I sent back. It would go to whatever story I wrote, it would go to an NCO. A staff NCO, generally. I was an NCO at the time. It's a non-commissioned officer. This would go to a lifer. The story would go to a lifer who was called the press chief. The press chief would then make his cuts and additions. From the press chief, It could go to the section chief, and he would add his or delete what he thought, then to the information officer himself in the division, and he would do what he was going to do with it. Then it would be passed up to Denang, to the press center in Denang, for third MAF, or Third Marine Amphibious Forces Press Center in Denang. And it would go through a whole battery of NCOs and officers up to a colonel before it was released to the press. And by the time it was released to the press, as I've said, it was hardly recognizable. Now, I say this because, ironically, the Marine Corps gave me its top three writing awards for the year 66-67, which was the first year of its Vietnamese correspondent awards. And I was rather bemused at the fact that I got the damn things. However, when they discovered that I was a Benedict Arnold, discovered it officially, I guess, the next year, I understand there was a caucus trying to take my awards away from me because I didn't deserve them. What we would do sometimes to counter all this thing that came down was find a few trusted Fourth Estaters, civilian pressmen, either television crews, take them to places where we were not supposed to take them, or try to tip off, as I said, trusted civilian reporters, because that was rather hot. Had a lot of rednecks in there that if you gave them some info, they would report it to your CO and you were on the carpet. Television crews the same way. Policy in the Marine Corps was if anything happened to the Marines, if there was any blunder or any slaughter because of short-sightedness or any mistake that cost Marine Corps lives, any military blunder, it was to be hidden, not to be shown. And if information did leak out, then it would be claimed as a great victory. In the meantime, such things as My Lai would never be reported. The body count, if a village were destroyed, the body count could stand as is, but suddenly you would find that there was a great big action around it. You know, one hell of a firefight. Really, from my end, that's essentially all I have to report for censorship.
Well, we couldn't talk about it.
Larry, can I interject a comment about...
Right in.
Okay. One of the things that really disturbed
WBAI,
me
New York.
As an information specialist in the Army, I realized what my job was, and I knew that if I wanted to keep this job, that was the only way I could do it, write the kind of stories that the Army wanted. I worked for a major, and I'd write his kind of propaganda. It was the only way to do it. But I, at that time, was under the impression that America had some sort of a free press and occasionally would attempt to talk to some of the representatives of the press from the states. One time in particular, I was especially disturbed. This was on April 10th, 1967. Three men from our office were killed during an attack. It was an incoming mortar round on the division headquarters. So three of our friends were killed. Vern was in the bunker with the three fellows who were killed when the round came in and went right into the bunker. His first comment on coming out of the bunker, and he was the first one out of it, was that bastard Johnson. That's what he had to say. This was the feeling in our office at that time, April 10th, 1967. Three of our friends were killed. We were disgusted with Johnson, with the U.S. policy there. This was the office feeling, and this was, to me, a story. Well, the next day, I had the job of bringing news releases from division headquarters into Saigon and distributing them. I went to CBS and told them what had happened and how we wanted to tell about what we felt that day and how we were so disgusted with the war. Well, these were GIs on duty in a war zone who wanted to tell how they felt. We were disgusted. We wanted to protest. We couldn't through the military. We tried to CBS. Mike Wallace from CBS came out with me on a helicopter. All he wanted to do was a sensational story about no top on the bunker. Vern and I and others were ready to testify about, or to tell him what we felt about the war. and who we were disgusted with, why we were unhappy with our friends being killed. No hard feelings toward the communists from that group. It was their mortar that did it, but as far as we were concerned, the fault was with the U.S. But the press at that time was not interested. That wasn't their kind of story. So what CBS wanted was a little sensationalism about no top on the bunker. And we were pleading with them to tell a story about how we actually felt, protesting the war, but it wasn't wanted.
Most of the press over there is over there for the same reason the generals and the lifers are over there. It's not to report the news so much as to further their own careers. And that's what it's all about. You know?
Another story I wrote was regarding an outfit that Dave was with. It was called McCormick's Raiders. Well, this was with the three-quarter cavalry, and a group got together, typists and clerks from the headquarters of the company, the three-quarter cavalry, who wanted to go out in some combat. Well, they didn't do anything. Maybe Dave should mention a little bit about what they did. But this is something that the media picked up. It was a funny story, McCormick's Raiders, and it meant nothing. Well, a TV crew...